Christmas is still to come for many people all over the world. For those following the Coptic calendar, it's next week, January 7th. The Ethiopian Orthodox Church observes Christmas on that day as well. But on the 40 days before, they fast. It's a vegan fast, no dairy, no meat. As part of our series on Christmas food around the world, NPR's Gregory Warner looks at what Ethiopians are not eating right now, but will eat later.
An Ethiopian kitchen can be a place of both succulence and self-denial. Standing in the kitchen of Abyssinia, an Ethiopian restaurant in Nairobi, with the owner, Abebe, we're watching a cook prepare what is Abebe's favorite food, kitfo. Raw beef whipped up with cardamom and chili and a spicy butter to taste more like delicate cheese than steak tartare.
Do you get hungry for it? Do you wish you were eating meat right now or no?
In fact, that gives a psychological edge to those of us who are fasting because I'm weakening my physical strength.
The hungrier you are, the more you feel.
The closer to God you are.
The hungrier you are, the closer you are to God, he says, especially at a time of year when others are gorging, he adds. There's something gratifying in self-denial. The Advent fast traditionally allows just one vegan meal a day in the afternoon or evening. Abebe has grown accustomed to serving foods with meat or dairy to his guests that he himself is forbidden to touch. He enjoys that sense of apartness.
To me, it enables me to deal with this world, because this world is full of challenge.
Does it make the Christmas better?
Yeah, I'm telling you, after 2 months of fasting, people eat, people drink.
Now, what they eat and drink when the Ethiopian Christmas finally arrives on January 7th is traditionally doro wat, poultry pieces drowned in rich red sauce. Abebe's wife, Shitai, explains that the Christmas doro wat is a bit different. You have to slaughter a rooster, not a hen, and carve it into exactly 12 pieces representing the 12 disciples.
Yeah, the drumstick and the thigh, the breast, the wings.
The wings are each cut in two, plus the neck and the back make 12. Add 12 hard-boiled eggs. Some say that symbolizes eternity, no beginning or end. But eternity is what it can feel like to make the sauce. You have to simmer down 9 pounds of chopped onion with the chili called berbere.
To prepare that onion, to make it ready, to make it tender, it takes like 4 to 5 hours.
But it's funny because all these people coming into the restaurant, they say, okay, I'll have one doro wat, and you make it. But it's such a special food for you.
Very, very special for us.
But that specialness is lost on the people.
Yeah, if you do it every day, it is true. But our guests are very special for us.
Nice save, Shitai. Nice save. Now, at precisely 2:45 p.m., when the break fast can begin, Abebe reemerges with a plate of spongy, sour flatbread called injera. There's a generous dollop of shiro, a chickpea and white bean dish with 11 ingredients, 9 of which are spices, and there are other scoops of lentils, kale, and other greens.
So can we bite?
Yeah, let's bite.
Yes, please. We are through now.
Yeah, quite true.
Okay, so it is, I can say, the most delicious fasting food I've ever consumed. Gregory Warner, NPR News, Nairobi.
There's a reason so many people make New Year's resolutions. More than any specific goal, people yearn for a chance for a fresh start. On this New Year's Day, NPR begins a series of reports called Starting Over. We tell stories of people who had to reinvent themselves. First, we travel to the mountains of Colorado, where a congregation has returned to their chapel after flooding destroyed the building. They've restored the building now, but KUNC's Grace Hood reports the real challenge lies ahead.
Chapel of the Interlude is a fitting name for a church in the middle of a narrow, winding canyon. In 1969, benefactors built the intimate wood paneled structure to provide an oasis next to one of the busiest roads leading to Rocky Mountain National Park.
Well, good morning.
In 2013, a raging river between Estes Park and Loveland, Colorado, deposited mud, sticks, and debris inside the chapel's fellowship hall. After stripping down the walls and carpet to remove mold and water damage, about 40 of its members have returned, including Harry Fitchner.
There's a lot of work, there's a lot of strain, a lot of stress, but we just kept coming together.
Decked out in suspenders, a handlebar mustache and beard, the 68-year-old tinkers with a new thermostat.
You see what we've got today? It's just building right back.
The church shed its 60s wood paneling for white walls and a tile floor. But one hurdle down, another to go. That's what it's like when you're starting over. Bus Tarbox, who's attended Interlude for 10 years, lays out the dilemma.
We have very few young people. We don't have any children. So we're going to have to appeal to the people who live up here. And so far, we haven't been real successful in doing that.
The average age in this congregation is 75. The oldest member just turned 101. Inside the tiny sanctuary, Pastor Dave Orison kicks off the service.
What are we thankful for this morning?
I'm thankful.
One churchgoer who's 90 says she's happy to finally get scheduled for an MRI.
If they don't hurry and find out why you're sick, you might just get well first, right?
Orison then starts a service he describes as gentle and non-abrasive.
All right, let's go to the Lord in prayer. Our Heavenly Father,
everything from Orison's delivery to use of traditional hymns is by design. Rock music may help fill the church pews, he says, but it can alienate those who are older.
I think many pastors have been pushed into the idea that growth is so important that disenfranchising certain groups is acceptable.
Orison says there's a delicate balance between bringing in younger members and retaining the older ones.
They're 90 years old. I mean, we have several of them who are 90 years old. I'm not going to encourage them to get out there and knock on doors and tell their neighbor that they need Jesus, you know?
And there are limits to how many people Chapel of the Interlude can recruit. The new sanctuary is already cramped. With overflow seating, they're squeezing in 60 people. After Sunday's service, the congregation snacks on brownies and cookies. Liz Fitchner, one of the youngest members at 55, says she loves the small community and from-the-heart sermons. Building up the church is about connecting with the right people.
See, before the flood, there was a house and a lot of trees in front of the church. You never knew there was a church here.
Now Fitchner says the house and trees are gone. Their oasis is more exposed.
So trying to bring some of the regular traffic maybe to come here and put it out that we're back open, that we're here again, worshiping together.
Chapel of the Interlude doesn't have a whole lot of extra space, but when you're starting over, there's plenty of room for growth. For NPR News, I'm Grace Hood.
Ebola has been on the minds of many people here in the U.S. over the past year. Media reports showed the horror of the outbreak in West Africa. Hundreds of Americans traveled overseas to fight the disease. And in this country, hospitals and airports came up with plans for dealing with those who had been exposed to the virus. Meanwhile, members of a church in Washington, D.C. were affected by Ebola in ways they never expected. NPR's Anders Kelto has our story.
Trinity Episcopal Church is a beautiful place. There are stone walls, wooden rafters, stained glass windows. And the congregation here is very international. They're from more than 20 countries, including several in West Africa. Reverend John Harmon, who's originally from Liberia, says when Ebola hit West Africa, the church pitched in.
This congregation gave $5,000 and were part of a national effort to send containers to West Africa.
Containers with medical supplies and protective suits. But then, in the midst of all this giving, a funny thing happened. Church attendance went way down. Nearly a quarter of the congregation, 50 people, just stopped showing up. At first, Reverend Harmon wasn't sure why. And then he started getting phone calls from parishioners.
Some folks called to say, you know, I'm not coming to church because I don't know who's traveling.
As in, who's traveling to West Africa. But here's the thing. No one was traveling to West Africa. Most West Africans in the congregation hadn't been back there in years. But still, some church members feared Ebola would somehow creep into the church. The low attendance continued for weeks, and Reverend Harmon started to get concerned. Then, at a church service in October, he finally addressed the elephant in the cathedral.
In the middle of the service, we just had this honest conversation.
You just kind of stopped and were like, we're going to talk about this.
Yes, that's what we did.
He asked parishioners to voice their concerns. And then he had several doctors from the congregation come up and talk about Ebola, including how it spread. Cora Dixon, a church member, says the doctor's talk was reassuring.
Several of them got up and they spoke to the cause and they relaxed our minds.
Then Reverend Harmon asked anyone traveling abroad to skip church for 3 Sundays, even if they weren't traveling to West Africa. He also said it was okay to nod or bow rather than shake hands during the passing of the peace. And he had the ushers put out 2 big bottles of hand sanitizer.
I used them when I get back to the altar. So that visible sign is that we are expressing care for each other.
And at any time, did you ever just kind of feel like, this is all a little crazy that we have to do this? I mean, Ebola is thousands of miles away. You don't have people going there. They're so...
Yes, I think it's important to really make people aware and, you know, address that concern.
Since Reverend Harmon addressed these concerns, attendance at Trinity has picked back up, almost to pre-Ebola levels. More people are showing up at community service events, too. Just before Christmas, the church hosted a dinner for homeless people. Adolphus Ukegbu, a church member who was originally from Nigeria, was there helping out, dishing up food and helping lead Christmas carols. Ukegbu said some members of Trinity are still avoiding church events because they're scared of Ebola. But for the most part, things are back to normal.
But since then, everybody peace now, everybody's shaking hands.
And know. With that, he grabbed hands with the people around him and kept singing. For the second year of Christmas, my true love. Anders Kelto, NPR News.
This morning we bring you a story of one woman who went from the pulpit to politics. It's part of a New Year's series called Starting Over, about how people are changed by choice or circumstance. Faith Whitmore was a pastor for 3 decades, but 2 years ago, she made the radical switch to work for a U.S. congressman from California. Reporter Emily Green has her story.
Faith Whitmore emerges from the congressman's office with a burst of energy that fills the spare surroundings.
Emily!
Hi!
Hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm good.
If you had asked her 3 years ago where she'd be today, this office would not be the place. Whitmore was ordained as a pastor 30 years ago, drawn by a deep sense of God and spirit within her. She worked at churches throughout the Sacramento region, eventually becoming senior pastor at one of the largest United Methodist congregations. It was, she says, like running a small business.
You have committees and property that you need to take care of and fundraising that has to happen. There are weddings and funerals and baptisms.
And of course, preaching. Here she is in the pulpit in 2011.
Christ engages the woman at the well, finding the lost, calling them by name, calling them home. That's what a church can do. That's what a healthy church can do. That's what a healthy church can be, a place of knowing and being known.
But after 3 decades doing this work, Whitmore was tired. She took a job leading a nonprofit that helps homeless people. Soon after, the Catholic Church stopped contributing to the group because as a pastor, Whitmore spoke out in support of same-sex marriage and Planned Parenthood. She says she wasn't pushed out of the job, but soon after, she accepted a position as district director for Democratic U.S. Congressman Ami Bera.
People say, well, how can you go from ministry to politics? Or they ask me, how long have you been in politics? I said, well, it depends on how you look at it, you know, maybe a couple of weeks, maybe all my life.
And as a pastor, you have to at least try to bring people together. Exactly how Whitmore came to work for Bera is a point of disagreement between the two longtime friends. Whitmore says he approached her. Bera says she approached him.
From my end, it was a no-brainer. You have someone who's trusted in the community, who's well-respected in the community, whose values align with my values, who really is a natural surrogate.
Of course, there's also the bare-knuckles politics of campaigning. Bera ran for re-election last year and won by a razor-thin margin. The candidates and their supporters spent more than $20 million on the election, the most expensive congressional race in the country. Bera says Whitmore got mad about the ads running against him.
We might be driving somewhere in a car going to an event, and she might vent to me a little bit. It's like, Faith, you're a member of the clergy. You can't use colorful language like that.
Swearing aside, Whitmore is still deeply religious. But things have changed. She doesn't go to church every Sunday and has no regrets about leaving behind her life as a pastor.
I'm growing older. And my time on earth is getting shorter. So some of the things I care about are on a larger scale. If I can care about health care for everybody, that's legislation. If I care about immigrant status, that's legislation.
Whitmore says it's about taking her Christian values into the world and fulfilling her vocation outside the pulpit. For NPR News, I'm Emily Green.